There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
This week on This American Life, even now when she talks about it, Deborah has a hard time understanding what got her and her kids to the point where the kids decided just to vanish, run away.
And I remember Amanda saying, "Mom, we don't want to hurt you."
A mom and her two kids try to reconstruct what went wrong, and other stories of parenting gone awry this week on This American Life, Public Radio International.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6.
In sports, Illinois is in Oregon tonight to take on Western Kentucky as the NCAA tournament gets underway. The Illini are still adjusting to the loss of senior guard Chester Frazier, who had surgery on his injured right hand last Thursday. In Frazier's absence, Illinois will lean on sophomore Dimitri McKamey and several bench players, including sophomore guard Jeff Jordan, the son of Michael Jordan. Let's take a look at some scores now from the NCAA tourney. It was Memphis 81 over California State Northridge, 81-70. LSU defeated Butler. The score there, 75-71. And at the half, Purdue was leading Northern Iowa 32-20. The St. Louis Blues continue their Canadian road trip with a game in Vancouver tonight. The Canucks will try for an 11th straight home victory. St. Louis, meanwhile, is coming off Tuesday night's 2-1 shootout loss in Edmonton. The Blues have lost 4 of the last 5 to the Canucks. And this year's LPGA State Farm Classic will be telecast by a major network for the first time. The tournament's executive director says NBC will show portions of the final 2 rounds. The State Farm Classic begins June 4th at Panther Creek Country Club in Springfield. That's sports. A retrospective on inventor and designer Buckminster Fuller just opened at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art, the only stop the show is making outside of New York. Fuller is best known for his geodesic dome. He also invented a large three-wheeled car and portable housing. Fuller's ideas, so ahead of their time, are finding new followers and interest today, decades later. The show outlines his deep Chicago ties. Illinois Public Radio's Lynette Kalsness went on a gallery tour.
I see that we really put specialization upon
it. Trisha Van Eck, I'm the curatorial coordinator and curator of artist books at the MCA. Buckminster Fuller was a visionary. Increasingly, many artists are looking to many of his thoughts, many of his designs. If Fuller would have invented some of the things that he worked out with the students at the Institute of Design, we would be in a different world now. Fuller's problem is he was too far advanced for people to really grab on. When he tried to solve a problem, he tried to find the beautiful solution because he thought that that's how nature works beautifully. And so he tried to make these geometric explorations to understand the underlying geometry of the world.
They are just beautiful. My understanding is he sort of had his great revelation that set him on this path in Chicago.
In 1927, Fuller had already lost his job. His daughter had died 4 years before. He wasn't a success by any means, and he contemplated suicide by going to Lake Michigan. And he was struck by the revelation he couldn't commit suicide because he had to enter into an experiment of what can one individual do to affect change.
Really good things happening about the computer, man, is it?
So the next room is really the showcase of the Dymaxion House. We have a model that was reconstructed in 1987.
Can we go closer and peek in the windows?
Yeah, so this is a hexagonal-shaped house that would literally be dropped down by an airplane. It was first displayed in 1929 at Marshall Field's. The top looks like a sail. All of the mechanicals are in the central mast, and all of it is supported from the central mast, just like a sail. The Demexian house, the Demexian car, and the geodesic dome are Bucky's real claim to fame.
I put him on this background, and this really is accurate.
My name is Allegra Fuller Snyder, and I'm Buckminster Fuller's daughter. I actually rode in that car. That was the first time that I realized that my father was doing something a little bit different than other people's fathers, because everybody would come surround the car. They were just absolutely amazed by it.
He was so wildly inventive. I wonder, was he just coming up with new ideas all the time?
No, not really. He was processing and reprocessing and reprocessing again. It is really very fundamental thoughts, which were there were a lot of critical problems in society that had to be changed so people would live more comfortably.
What is your sense when you look around exhibits like this of what your father's significance or achievements are?
I'm very excited that this exhibit is taking place now, because I think we as a society, unfortunately, for the first time, recognize these issues that he had been talking about many years before. The issue of environment, the critical changes that were going to occur because of our misuse of fossil fuels and so forth, he was really asking of himself and all of us to ask really the very biggest questions we possibly could, and to realize at the same time that particularly with tools and technology, that they were answerable in a positive way.
The show runs through June 21st at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Indiana University's Jacobs School of Music recently received a wonderful gift, a gift from the children of American conductor, composer, pianist, and educator Leonard Bernstein. The family has donated the carefully preserved contents of his main Fairfield, Connecticut composing studio to Indiana. The collection will be displayed in a space that will be used as a teaching studio available to students, faculty, and guests. Philip Pinella is the director of the William and Gail Cook Music Library at Indiana. He oversees all aspects of library operations and IT support for the Jacobs School of Music in Bloomington, and he joins me this afternoon to talk about the Bernstein family's gift. Philip Pinella, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Leonard Bernstein had a close connection with Indiana University. He fell in love with the place. Why was he so fond of Indiana University?
Well, it was really by chance, actually, that his manager at the time, in the late 70s and into the 80s, called the school asking if the school would be interested in having him come and spend some time here. And, of course, the dean at the time said, of course, why would we say no? And he was looking for a place where he could workshop some of the things he was working on. So Indiana was renowned for having an excellent opera program, and he was at the time working on the opera A Quiet Place. And so he spent almost 2 months here. He would compose most of the night and then come in the next day and have students give him immediate feedback. They'd play through some of the things he was working on, and they could give him ideas as to what was really hard and what, you know, was really really sounded great and what was difficult. So it was a great relationship. He really enjoyed his time here and found it to be incredibly valuable, and he always looked fondly on the school even after he left.
Yeah. In 1988, he got a call from François Mitterrand. The Paris Opera needed some help in order to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Bastille Day. What happened as a result of that telephone call?
Well, that was before my time, but as I understand it, they were having a problem. The opera house was about to open, and they were having a problem as to what to schedule. And Bernstein had this idea of showcasing some of the greatest student orchestras in the world. And so, of course, he started off with us, and so we ended up sending a group of students there to perform a series of concerts along with several other orchestras for the grand opening of that hall.
Yeah, and that was just one of the opportunities that Indiana music students had as a result of the connection between Leonard Bernstein and the School of Music.
Right. My favorite of the stories, and again, these all predate me in my time here in Indiana, but was in 1988, the Tanglewood Festival was planning to have a celebration for his 70th birthday, and they asked him what he would like to see performed, and he had suggested that Mass, his Mass that he had written in 1971. And they were really hesitant to do that because it requires really large forces, and it requires a jazz band and a children's choir, and you know they don't have those forces available to them during the summer. And he said, well, why don't we just call Indiana? I'm sure they can help us out. And sure enough, our dean wasn't going to miss the opportunity, and we ended up sending some 250 people to Tanglewood that summer and gave a wonderful performance of Mass. And it's rumored, I you know, again, this is what I has been passed down, is that he said that it was perhaps the finest concert he had ever heard, not just of Mass, but of anything he had ever heard.
Wow.
So we make a lot of those kinds of quotes.
Yeah. Well, what is in the studio collection? What does this composing studio contain?
Well, it's an unusual collection. It has some rare treasures that are simply priceless, and it has a lot of mundane things. This was literally his working studio, so in there, he had a number of special things that had been given to him over time. For example, a conducting stool that was given to him for his 70th birthday by the Vienna Philharmonic that belonged to Brahms, the composer Johannes Brahms. So there are things like that and other mementos given to him. There's actually a signed certificate, a citation he received from François Mitterrand, as a matter of fact, from France. And there are things like that, but then there are also the routine things that you and I have in our offices as well, pencils and pencil sharpeners, and, you know, the desk that he composed at, which is a beautiful piece of furniture, had in it, you know, the manuscript paper and stationery and business cards and things like that. So it really runs the gamut of the sublime to really mundane things, but that's, I think, makes it a very special collection that it really honors him as a man.
Yeah. Does the studio offer insight into how he composed his works?
Well, it remains to be seen. I think there are some interesting, when we put the pieces together and we gather a lot of the stories, we're in touch with the Bernsteins, and because there are a number of things, again, that unless you know, oh, that was given to him by someone, you know, famous, you don't know. But as you learn more and more about how he worked, for example, this studio was built out behind their main house. He had two residences. He had an apartment in Manhattan that he lived at, but the demands on his time were so great that he really couldn't get any work done there in terms of composing. So they bought a house in the early 60s in Fairfield, Connecticut. But even at that, they ended up building a Sears kit home. You know, they don't make them like that anymore, where you could actually buy a kit from the Sears catalog and build a house out in the back of the main house. So he would work all night out there, and because then he would really work uninterrupted, and he would have no demands on his time except whatever he wanted to do. So he would work all night and then sleep a good part of the day. And so you see, as you look at some of the belongings that he has there, that this really became sort of a little studio apartment for him that he had all to himself and that he could really go to really get a lot of work done.
What are some of the works he composed in that studio?
Well, virtually every work from 1962 on is what we're told. I mean, he did work, obviously, other places because he traveled so much. But Quiet Place, the opera that he worked on here in Bloomington, was completed there. But nearly every major work that he composed after 1962 was worked on in that studio.
How will the studio be useful to students, faculty, and visitors?
You know, that's an interesting question and one that we spent a lot of time debating when they first contacted us last year regarding this gift. I mean, one of my first questions for our dean was, do we have the space? And B, even if we had the space, do we really want to be closing off a complete room that's more of a museum setup when, as you probably are aware, any college campus space is at a premium and really hard to find? So we really debated what that would mean, and We are currently in the early stages of planning a new building. We hope to break ground next fall. So that will open up, of course, a lot of opportunities for us. So the final destination for this room is yet to be determined. However, we think the best use will be this. We will, of course, preserve and protect and set the studio up to the way it was in Fairfield to the best of our ability. But we'd like this to be a studio for guest faculty. We do have a number of guest artists and faculty who come in for a few days to a few months, and they don't really have a place to work with students and to, you know, to regularly have an office-type space. So we hope that we can set this up in a way that the real treasures are preserved and under glass or in display cases. Yet there is also a working component to the room, and also we are obligated to the family to make it available publicly if people, general public, would like to come in and see it. So we're hoping to balance that museum-type display in a way that honors Bernstein and his legacy, and but it also inspires our students and our faculty to have a room that is really useful and one that they can go in to gain new insights about him and his music and also about their own musicianship and be inspired to become better musicians and educators.
When do you think the new building will open?
It's hard for me to say. I would guess it's at least 2 to 3 years off. So we know we have a few years where we're going to have to come up with some interim solutions with regards to this collection. We have a small portion of it on display right now in our in the lobby of our Musical Arts Center, and we will continue to have bits and pieces where we can. But we also have a few other museum spaces here in on the Bloomington campus, and we hope to perhaps display parts of it there as well, you know, when the opportunities present themselves.
Yeah, boy, I imagine that a grand celebration will accompany the opening of the new building and this studio.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, Philip Pinella, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon, and congratulations to the Jacobs School of Music.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Philip Pinella is the director of the William and Gail Cook Music Library at Indiana. He oversees all aspects of library operations and IT support for the Jacobs School of Music in Bloomington. The school recently received a wonderful gift from the children of American conductor, composer, pianist, and educator Leonard Bernstein. The family has donated the carefully preserved contents of his main Fairfield, Connecticut composing studio to Indiana.
Earth and sky.
Scientists are studying the significance of a kiss. But what can science tell us about kissing that we don't already know?
It can tell you why kissing is so meaningful and why we're so scared of that first kiss, whether it's going to be right or wrong. And we somehow sense that kissing is a powerful stimulant of certain brain systems or a powerful turnoff to certain brain systems.
You're listening to anthropologist Helen Fisher of Rutgers University and chief scientific advisor to the online dating site chemistry.com.
The brain is a very fine mechanism for establishing whether we think we're wasting our time on a romantic relationship or not.
Fisher said that when people kiss, they are receiving and interpreting chemical signals. She said testosterone and estrogen are absorbed into the bloodstream through the cheek cells and make their way into the brain. Kissing can drive up levels of dopamine, associated with falling in love, and oxytocin, which is associated with feelings of attachment.
5 of the 12 cranial nerves become activated